You know what a freedom fighter is? A freedom fighter in modern times, 2021, 2022. A freedom fighter is someone who fights for the freedom to think, to say what you mean, to think about things, to discuss them, like the epidemic of crime savaging the people of Chicago and elsewhere throughout the country, and most of them are minorities. Glenn Cartman Lowry is such a freedom fighter. He's an American economist, academic, author. And in 1982, at the age of just 33, he became the first African-American tenured professor of economics in the history of Harvard University. He's now at Brown University, and he fights for the freedom to think at one of the America's most left-wing campuses. Barry Weiss, in her intro to Glenn Lowry and one of her podcasts, said, "I think Glenn embodies what the philosophers call a man in full. Glenn is a man who, in a time of lies, told for the sake of political convenience, strives to tell the truth even when the truth is hard or complicated or an affront to our feelings or contradicts what we wish were true." He was born here in Chicago on the South Side. And recently, scanning Twitter, I saw a video posted by our friend Paul Vallis of that CTA bus driver who was savagely beaten on Michigan Avenue, the crowd screaming an exhortation. And I retweeted it with my own commentary, which I condemned Mayor Wokefoot, Tim Evans, Kim Fox, Tony Preckwinkle for the policies that have led to lawlessness and chaos. Glenn Lowry tweeted, "This is not systemic racism," and I'm quoting here, "rather it is savagery running amok right in the center of my hometown, Chicago. The perpetrators are black youth. About this fiasco, there is not a mumbling word to be heard from the liberal anti-racists. I wonder why not." Jeff Carlin is here, my friend, executive producer at WGN Radio, master of pies, lover of cats. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, publisher, or what? Editor, what? Just writer at johncassnews.com. And we're going behind the paywall soon. Not a lot of money, but I don't work for free. And after all, we are not communists, like Don Barzini said. And where are you with cities tearing themselves apart, with woke politicians now like Mayor London Breed of San Francisco saying she's not going to stand for the bullshit anymore, fighting back like a crime fighter, and all the other nonsense and screaming and yelling and finger pointing and back and forth, and back and forth, while the cities descend into chaos and anarchy? You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
And it's time that the reign of criminals who are destroying our city, it is time for it to come to an end. And it comes to an end when we take the steps to be more aggressive with law enforcement, more aggressive with the changes in our policies, and less tolerant of all the bullshit that has destroyed our city.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Castle.
And here we are, as promised, with Professor Glenn Lowry. I was stunned to see his response to a tweet I'd done. It was the beating of the bus driver on Michigan Avenue, the crowd screaming. And I blamed it, as I often do, on the woke politicians whose policies have led to this lawlessness. And he retweeted it, saying, "This is not systemic racism. Rather, it's savagery running amok right in the center of my hometown, Chicago. The perpetrators are black youth. About this fiasco, there is not a mumbling word to be heard from the liberal anti-racists. I wonder why not." And it's our great pleasure to welcome Glenn Lowry, professor of economics at Brown University, to the Chicago.
Good to be with you, John. I'm very happy to be with you.
So there's so much to talk about with you, but can we start with that? Your reaction to that beating, and how it distilled a lot, for me at least, of what's going on now.
Well, I haven't lived in Chicago in a long time. Let me say that. I last lived in Chicago in 1979. That's a long time ago. So I'm out here on the East Coast. I have been for decades. But I was born and raised in the city, and it just breaks my heart to see the descent into chaos and lawlessness that incident that you were tweeting about represents. That's only one of a number that could be cited. That loss of civility and savagery of these attacks and what they say about the state of African-American society, lower class, if you will, but still, it's deeply troubling to me, emblematic of things that I think are badly off track in America more broadly. And yeah, I think some of the blame has to be laid at the feet of the people who are in charge of the city, of its institutions of order, maintenance, and so on. So, you know, I was moved by what you put up there and thought I should share it with my followers.
Professor, we see this all over the country with even now London Breed, great name, by the way, the mayor of, although not a great mayor, the mayor of San Francisco, is now railing about lawlessness in her city that she helped promote, and said, "We're going to stop the BS and all this." And she's very upset about it. And I wonder, when we see progressive mayors, not Mayor Mayor Wokefoot, obviously, but other progressive mayors condemn this stuff, what does that tell us?
Well, it tells you, I think, in the first instance, that some of these people are responsive to the sentiments of their electorate. The public are clamoring for something to be done. And I think it bespeaks the failure of a part of the progressive overreaction to mass incarceration, to the sense that we had too many people in prison, that, you know, our sentences are too long, that we were too punitive, that the drug war was overdrawn, and so on. There was that sense. I myself, in fact, was quite sympathetic to the idea that we needed to take a good long look at what we were doing. At, you know, 2.5 million people under lock and key on a given day was too many, that the racial disproportion was troubling, that there was something to the idea of a school to prison pipeline. Those notions are not crazy, but I think people have overreacted. So the, you know, getting rid of bail and the leniency of not bringing cases against people, the decision not to enforce property crime laws below a certain level, and the general reaction to the George Floyd killing and the sense of police brutality being a problem. Progressives gotten themselves elected as prosecutors and mayors in a number of cities, and they pursued policies, I think, that have not worked. And I believe that there's a blowback from that. And smart politicians are trimming their sails a little bit and adjusting their rhetoric. although it may be too little too late.
The professor, again, thanks so much for joining us. It's really an honor. And one of the things I want to draw people to is a piece that John shared with me of yours, but I think it appears on firstthings.com, but it's a piece about the case for Black patriotism from and it's this idea, like everything you just described are a lot of reasons for people to be upset, right? Especially Black people in this country who have been mistreated, no, without argue, over the history of this country. That's a fact. But the way people have reacted to it is what's really got us to this time now. And it's this idea that people, if I do the biggest, loudest, craziest thing to make things better, I'm going to get the most attention. And as a result, people are following that. And I've seen that many Blacks and even in liberal whites in this country feel like they're angry or they're mad or they hate our country because of what our country is. And you make the case that it's really the other way, that you're using the country the wrong way almost. And I just wanted to for a few minutes, because people need to check this out. It's The Case for Black Patriotism. It's a great piece. But you explore that a little bit with us.
Sure, Jeffrey. Happy to do that. That piece comes out of a speech that I gave at the National Conservatism Conference in Orlando, Florida, a month and a half, 2 months ago. And I went down there. These are conservatives. This is Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio were amongst the keynote speakers, and Peter Thiel kicked the thing off. And these are conservatives. And it wouldn't necessarily be my natural political home, except that I was thinking they're talking about America. And I believe that there's an important message, which is that African-Americans have everything to gain from embracing our birthright citizenship and our place within the larger American national project. Rightly understood, that is the framing of African-American striving that is time-tested, that is most politically viable, and that is the morally correct interpretation of our historical experience. I was against Colin Kaepernick taking the knee and all of the celebratory reaction to that, because I thought, police brutality, that's a legitimate issue. If you've got a beef, you've got a beef. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't refute or prove to be erroneous the idea that America is a great nation. Indeed, that America, viewed properly in its history, historical context, is the greatest force for human liberty on the planet. And I said, let's just take a look at the full picture. Yes, slavery happened, but emancipation also happened. What was emancipation? 4 million people who were property were converted into citizens of the Republic. They were not equal citizens at first, but in the fullness of time, we have become equal citizens of the Republic. There's no other record of any such transformation in the history of human civilization to match the tremendous achievement, which was the making of the African enslaved people and their descendants into full citizens of this Republic, the richest and most powerful people of African descent on the planet. I say our Americanness here now in the 21st century is much more important than our Blackness. And I say that to take a political stand in which we oppose our interests to that of America, we stand apart from the country as if we could go to the United Nations or the World Court and get satisfaction for our claims is an absurdity. We have no choice but to sit down with our fellow Americans around the table and come to some understanding how it is that we're going to live together and conduct our affairs in this country. So there's nothing wrong with Black patriotism. It's actually the natural response to history, I want to claim. And since that was a message that you very seldom hear in this day era of the 1619 Project, I thought it was worth putting out as far and wide as I could get it put out.
And I'm sure you were singed for it.
Singed? Well, yeah, but I'm long past worrying about that, John.
I know you are. You are a full chair. You're chairman of the department. You're not in your 20s, starting out in the academic world. You're in your full years.
That's one way to put it.
That's one way to put it.
Let me just say, I'm not chair of the department. I am a chair. I hold a chair in the department. The Merton Stoltz professor, that's the name of my chair. But there's another guy, God help him, who's got the unenviable job of herding the cats in my department.
The one before we get into your life in Chicago, I consider you and guys like you to be true freedom fighters, in the sense that you're in these woke environments. There's nothing more woke than an East Coast Ivy League school.
Yeah.
And you are fighting for the freedom, the intellectual, academic freedom of your colleagues to be able to think and mull over problems. And this runs counter to the goose stepping I see now and we see all over the culture. How's that been for you? I know you're a tough guy. You're from Chicago. You're a Southsider. it's got to be difficult, at least when you began.
It has its downside, to be sure. And I don't get as many cocktail party invitations as I might like to receive, and that's okay. But it also has its rewards. I mean, first of all, I feel like I'm doing the right thing. And even if we are relatively few here in the Ivy League and in academia more broadly, who are standing up for freedom of inquiry and an open forum and who are concerned about excesses from the diversity, inclusion, and equity mongers, and are trying to, offer a different point of view. I mean, I'm an economist, for example. So
right.
I actually think that there are some good virtues in capitalism. And and I don't think private property is the enemy of civilization and et cetera, et cetera. And, that's becoming a rarer and rarer position as time goes on in the academy. But in any case, there are some rewards here. Some of the students that I have are just absolutely wonderful, and they are very appreciative of being able to get a different point of view. I taught a course on race and inequality just in this last semester that's concluding now. And although the kids are basically liberal, they're mostly left of center. They're mostly pro Black Lives Matter. They're pro affirmative action. They're pro reparations. I laid out my arguments. I offered them the other side as well, but I laid out my arguments. And I got a lot of notes from them saying, we really appreciate, even when we don't disagree, hearing the other side. Gosh, we don't ever hear the other side. Thank you for providing us, opening our eyes, making us aware of the fact that there are serious arguments here. I've never really thought about it like that, this kind of thing. So
that
it's okay.
That has to be rewarding.
That is very rewarding, John. And, I've got tenure, and yes, I'm in my 70s by now, and, I'm relatively bulletproof. You can go ahead and try to cancel me if you want to.
Now I'm not a what do they call that now? I'm not a public intellectual. I don't think you act like a public intellectual, but you're a man. You're bulletproof, I would say, politically. And you come from a city where, in my experience, not as just a broken down city hall reporter going out to the neighborhoods talking to people, I've never felt. I mean, I felt yes, there was resentment among Black people for mistreatment from police and mistreatment from the political machines, but I never felt that wokeness, that's expressed by, I guess, white Jacobin neo-Marxists leading African Americans into some sort of revolutionary position, which I find objectionable. I always felt that the people that I talked to on the South Side and 73rd in Michigan,
is
really not that far. I mean, it's only 15 minutes from 52nd in Peoria, where I was from and born.
Yeah.
Is that I never felt a wokeness, even during the 60s and 70s. I never felt this acidic wokeness that I see now in media. I don't see it in the neighborhoods. I see it in media and in discussions.
I think you're putting your finger on something very important. You call them Jacobin. Okay. I'm not going to argue with you about that.
They just hate that. That's why I said it.
You know, critical race theory loving, intersectionality spouting, fringe. This is a fringe of American society, and it's definitely a fringe of African American society. I mean, for example, those churches are still full of people on Sunday morning up and down the avenues on the south side of Chicago. Right. They still think Jesus is Lord. Pardon me for, you know, a sectarian observation, but they're Christians and they believe in it. These people are conservative. I mean, conservative to with respect to some of the latter day, you know, liberationist movements that are tossing over the cultural inheritance of generations of working class African-American society. That's not authentic to the African-American experience. That's an interesting phenomenon that it would take an intellectual historian to parse adequately. But I think that's not really, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. and company, even W.E.B. Du Bois and company would not have recognized that as an expression of African-American experience.
And it becomes destructive when, in my view, when political actors like Lori Lightfoot, Kim Fox, are responding to the fringe, fringe white Marxists and begin to govern to satisfy them rather than the people of the neighborhoods who are saying, look, I mean, there's guys who go to work and raise a family and go to church, and they don't want to get shot. They don't want their kid. They want their kids to play in a park. They don't want to be carjacked, and on. It's like there's several different cultures at play here: the reality of what's going on the ground, and the nonsense that we're spouting on these floating islands of ours. When we talk about politics,
I think we have to look past some of the figureheads, the political spokespersons, and look at what's going on the grassroots and try to identify leadership at a more grounded level. I think of Pastor Corey Brooks, mm-hmm. whom I understand on the South Side has a ministry that he's trying to provide some leadership and structure for young people and trying to call out for opposition to all the violence that's going on. I don't live in Chicago anymore. I don't really know, you know, who these personalities would be, but, right. You know, there are leaders and then there are leaders. There are people who run for office, and obviously that's important, but there are also people who organize at a more fundamental level in the communities, and they should be supported and more widely known, I think.
But as newsrooms become more and more woke, and the ones in Chicago are clearly so, the news people have a funny way of selecting black leaders, and I put that in quotes. You know, we select the guy who screams the loudest, who doesn't know enough, and who satisfies our needs for clicks and sensationalism, and it doesn't necessarily translate into leadership.
Yeah. You're the journalist or the ex newspaper newsroom guy. I'm not. I'm just somebody who's watching from afar, but it amazes me how corrupt, in my opinion, media have become, how politicized. They're not telling me all the stuff that I need to know. For example, this guy that drove that vehicle into that Christmas parade in Waukesha, Wisconsin, I want to know everything about him. I want to know what he ate for breakfast. I want to know who his cousins and his friends are. I want to know where he was when he was 10 and where he was 12 years old. I want to know everything about the world that he came from. If he were a white supremacist person and he had run over a bunch of black people with a vehicle, There'd be no end to the investigative resources that news organizations would have devoted to exposing the underside of what produced that vicious act. I want to know everything about this person, and I feel that I'm being failed by the media. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I will not. I've written the same thing. I want to know too. And they avoid it because it goes against, what's the word that they love now? Their narrative, right?
Yeah.
It violates their contract with their narrative. Let me ask you, Glenn, let me ask you, what was it like growing up? What was your childhood like on the South Side at 73rd or 2nd in Michigan? What was the neighborhood like then?
Yeah, well, actually, it was a pretty pleasant, as in my, you know, I'm in my 70s now, so it's been a while. Okay, this is the 1950s and 1960s in Chicago. I remember going to ball games at Comiskey Park. I remember Dineen Elementary School on 72nd in Wabash. I remember the street that I lived on, the block between 73rd and 74th Street on Michigan Avenue. It was leafy green. There were lawns. There were single-family homes, bungalows, two flats, the occasional courtway building, but I don't think there was any on that block. There were fruit trees in the backyards. We played stickball in the alley. It was safe. You could ride your bicycle in to the night, you know, east or west, north or south, without concern. Chatham to our south, Hyde Park not far away. I remember when the Dan Ryan Expressway was built. I was a kid, cut right down through that, the middle of that community. It was idyllic in retrospect. A gunshot? You never heard it. Sex workers on the walking on the avenue? You never saw it. Gang banging? Okay, well, maybe a little bit on the west side of the Dan Ryan Expressway, but not so much.
It was sharks and jets.
Yeah, that's exactly. And they fought with knives and
they had
brass knuckles if they were going to fight.
They had rumbles in the alley. I know that my cousins were part of it. I mean, you know, the different tribes, the blacks and whites and Irish and Lithuanians and everything.
Very ethnic and Polish and Greeks and
right. Greeks were just gamblers. We were just taking the money. We weren't really gangsters. Although it's a stupid joke because one of the top gangsters in Chicago was Greek and directed the politics of Chicago for years, Gus Alex. But we didn't have the street violence that we have today. It was a different time where a child could grow up. I don't know, for lack of a better word, in a normal life.
And the Blackstone Rangers were around. You know, the disciples were around, I remember, from the 60s.
Sure.
But I gather it's nothing, and there weren't as many guns. There just weren't as many. I gather every kid in some of these tough neighborhoods in Chicago now can't leave the house without tucking a gun under their belt.
Yeah, I guess you don't want to be reading. You can't think about reading the Federalist Papers when you have to have a gun on you at the same time. It's just difficult. but the life then, what do you remember going to that? So you're a Sox fan. You grew up a Sox fan, obviously, Southside.
I did. I'd make it out to Wrigley Field because it's a beautiful place to go from time to time. But I was a Sox fan growing up on the South Side. And, you know, I remember the 1959 World Series where we lost to the Dodgers. But, we were in the World Series 59. I was in the fifth grade at the time of that, sixth grade at the time of that great event. I'm a Sox fan, or was anyway.
You ever get back to Chicago?
Rarely, and rarely to the neighborhoods. Sad to say, most of my family have either passed on or have many cousins moved. They moved to Texas, John. Really? There's a whole branch of my mother's side of the family that has sprouted in Houston, Texas, and they've moved to Southern California and whatnot. A lot of them have moved out of Chicago. I still have a son, Alden, who lives in Chicago, works for WBZ and their equity desk. He's a senior editor there. Alden Lowry. And shout out to my son, Alden, if he happens to be listening to John Cass, which I doubt very seriously, but well.
I think, you know, this is like, remember the CIA had, what did they have, like Radio Free Europe?
Yeah, right.
So John Cass and Jeff Carlin are like, you know, are like that program in certain precincts. That's all I'll say. But, yeah. But you, well, congratulations to your family, to your son. I hope he gets out of journalism with his spirit intact. It's a difficult life, but so is academic. There's nothing more political than academic politics, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I can't get my provost and my president here at this great university, Brown University, where I'm a professor, to listen to anything I have to say. They have just completely turned me off and are pursuing willy-nilly, wrong-headed policies, as far as I can see, without my consultation, which, you know, it's their prerogative. But
well, you wrote that famous letter.
Well, yes, I did.
Challenging the president, or the whatever his title was.
She, really? Christina Paxson, president of Brown University, within days of the killing of George Floyd, issued a letter signed by every top administrator of Brown University expressing what she calls Brown values and lamenting the systemic racism which had risen up and expressed itself in the killing of George Floyd, and which threatens every Black person in this country. And our university was not going to rest until we did everything that we could and devoted all of our resources to uprooting systemic racism as was manifested in that case. It's just like a lynching from the 1950s, and we're not going to stand for it. Jesus. And I was outraged by that. I was outraged by it.
Because
it presumes something that remains yet to be demonstrated, which is that Derek Chauvin acted with racial motivation when he killed George Floyd. No one has shown that.
Yeah,
that event, which did involve a white man and a Black man, was not, in my view, a racial event. It was bad policing. It wasn't racism. It remains to be demonstrated that it was racism. We choose to construct it that way. Well, that choice has very serious consequences. If you want to take every event of criminal violation and construct it in racial terms, believe me, there are a lot of white victims of Black criminals. Is that the way you want to talk about it? Criminals need to be dealt with when they act badly. Bad policemen need to be dealt with when they act badly. Making it into a racial incident and saying that it brings back memories of Emmett Till, which is what the president of an Ivy League university did without evidence, is tendentious, ideological, irresponsible, and has no place in a university. Our job is not to virtue signal. Our job is to get to the bottom of things. That's why I wrote that letter. It still pisses me off, frankly, that she would arrogate to herself the right to pronounce moral judgments for a university. We're here to think things through. There are two sides to almost every issue. What's your evidence? What's your argument? She didn't have an argument. She was waving a banner. That was an outrage.
Well put.
In the time of lies, I'm looking at a Barry Weiss introduction to one of your visits with her on her podcast. Glenn is a man who, in a time of lies told for the sake of political convenience, strives to tell the truth, even when the truth is hard or complicated or an affront to our feelings or contradicts what we wish were true. But isn't that the job of the journalist and the academic, to think about things and pull them apart and see how they work and not to crusade under a banner?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I wish more of my colleagues thought that way.
But you know what? You could at least you could be thankful of the reception that you received from your colleagues, because I understand that out of the hundreds and hundreds of professors there, three wrote you a note saying, thank you.
That's about right. I haven't done a count. Maybe it's four, but it's certainly not 20. It's not 20. I can name the people who have, you know, let me know that they appreciate what it is that I'm doing. The rest of them, I guess they're kind of appalled and they're standing there agape in silence, you know, embarrassed for me. They're embarrassed for me.
That's the thing that's infuriating. I went through a similar experience, as some of you know. A handful of colleagues wrote me and said, I'm sorry that they're doing this to you. But I felt that the majority would have agreed with me, but that they were afraid to speak. And I think that that fear applies in academic life and in the woke newsrooms of America and elsewhere in the culture, where people are afraid to congratulate or thank someone for offering a different point of view. And it's that, I don't know, what is it? Totalitarianism, fascism, whatever you want to call it. Jeffrey
alluded earlier to social media, and we do live in a different environment right now where people can organize their oppositions and express themselves, and we can communicate massive numbers of people in an instant. And maybe this environment leads us to be more protective of our reputations. We don't want to say something that will get around and will cause all of our Twitter associates to stop, you know, thinking well of us or to say bad things about us or
right.
Whatever. I don't know. Frankly, I'm not, as I say, I'm not an intellectual historian. I think you need somebody, you know, of that sort to get to the bottom of what's happened to us in terms of the way we present ourselves in society. But people are very, very cautious of seeming to be on the wrong side of history. And I don't know that I think the advent of Donald Trump and all the political controversy has created this environment where if you say something that somebody who supports Trump might be willing to say, then you're in bad odor. And so you definitely don't want to seem to be confirming that part of the, of the spectrum of American opinion. You're going to be a respectable member of the Academy or in your newsroom or whatever.
Well, I'd rather be not respectable. I find that desire to be part of the hive, to be antithetical to the whole business of thinking for yourself. And you do. You think for yourself.
Yes, sir.
Go on, please.
No, well, I was just going to, maybe this is a parting thought, say one of the things that I think is that the homicide rate and the toll that it's taking, and not just in Chicago, but also in St. Louis, and not only there, but also in Baltimore, and not just there, but also in Philadelphia and in many other places beside, and the devastating impact that that's having on Black lives deserves to be denounced from every microphone that anybody who's got an audience who's concerned about the well-being of Black people. Black lives actually do matter. Ironically, the movement Black Lives Matter seems not to be addressing itself to the places in American society where Black lives are being lost in the tens and hundreds and thousands per year. This is the issue confronting urban Black America today. Carjackings, it's the issue. You can't open a business on the corner without a plexiglass bulletproof shield to do your commerce from behind. It's the issue. You can't stand at a bus stop without worrying that you're going to be killed in a drive-by shooting. You can't sit on your stoop with your infant on your lap without worrying that somebody's going to put a bullet between her eyes. It's the issue confronting Black America. And the fact that it's not being denounced and attacked and mobilized against by people who call themselves the leadership of this community is a shame.
With that, we'll say goodbye to Glenn Lowry, freedom fighter, freedom fighter for thinking. Thank you, Professor, for being here on the Chicago Way. And when, if you ever do come to Chicago, I would love to break bread with you, sir.
Oh, that's very kind, John. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome, Jeffrey. Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
So, Jeff, that was an honor to have Glenn Lowry on our podcast. I've read him. I've listened to him. And just to be able to talk to him and hear his the emotion in his voice when he's talking about these issues. What did you think?
You know, he doesn't, you know, you're too many people out there who are like, well, I've got a degree and I've experienced this, so I can speak on anyone's experience as such, right? Like, he wouldn't bait on talking about newsrooms or media stuff because it's not his wheelhouse, if you will. And I totally respect that. And that's the whole idea, like the president of the university coming out just within a couple of days being like, oh, you know, George Floyd this, George Floyd that, you know, and some lynching without having any of the facts. And it's like that idea that, you know, if you don't know, you don't know. And that's OK. You don't have to come out. You can be upset because something happened, but you don't have to be all of a sudden enraged because who you think did something, or you don't mean the facts.
Take you can easy. You can even be enraged, I think, Jeff.
Yeah,
but, you can. But what you don't do is immediately make a pronouncement that by its very nature shuts off any discussion about what happened. We see this too much in the world of science, where the left tells us follow the science and then doesn't follow the science. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at the swimming records in Pennsylvania, right? In the women's swimming by the biological male who's crushing the records. Is that following the science to call him a male or to call him a female? I'm not trying to condemn the individual. I'm talking about the general or saying this is George Floyd was this is what happened when you don't know, or in Ferguson, Missouri, this is what happened when you don't know. Why don't we find out? That's what reporters do and academics do.
And John, I think that one of the driving things behind it is this idea that, you know, the first person to yell the loudest about racism or bigotry or sexism or whatever ism it is they don't agree with or they think is inherently bad, which I'm not saying any of those aren't bad, but my point is that if you can get to the front page of the internet first and yell about it, you're going to get noticed first, right? I mean, I imagine every time I see something like this, the old gag, and I only say old because it was a little past or pre my time, but in movies where it's like, oh, the court, you know, some story happens at City Hall and all the reporters sprint down the street to the phone booths to ring it in. Well, that was because they were delivering facts. This is where we're doing it into the internet, where we're just delivering outrage or emotion.
We're not only delivering outrage, pardon me, Jeff.
Yeah.
We're also, but you're right, but we're also delivering, I guess, I don't know what, issuing edicts that serve as parentheses so that, or some punctuation so that nothing beyond what we say can be discussed or be, you know, lend itself to some fuller understanding because it's political.
Right. We talked about how politics is kind of, it used to be politics was one thing, and then you said, oh, well, we're not going to talk politics. Let's talk whatever. But now politics is in everything. And I don't know how we got here, but I know it's not good for all of us.
What's good is people like Glenn Lowry and others who are freedom fighters for the ability to think and speak. And without them, all we have are mobs run by Jacobin punks.
Yeah.
Or you can take it on the other side and have, you know, McCarthy, you know,
yeah,
McCarthyite punks from the right, now it's of the left, and they're destroying universities, they're destroying newspapers, they're destroying everything. And the corporate world has to, I guess, grow the bleep up and realize what they're doing to the country. And that's why I'm so glad, Jeff, that we had Glenn Lowry as our guest today.
Yeah, certainly interesting and a good American. I mean, it's just the sheer fact that one of the opening phrases he said, you know, going down to a conservative action meeting to speak and how that's not, you know, it's not who he is, but he did it because, you know, the idea of sharing thoughts and sharing ideas and expressing things. And that's the whole point of education. It's a whole
dialogue.
Right. Exactly. And I just see him get so emotional too when he's talking about the president of Brown and the whole George Floyd thing is just proof to see, like, you know, people are trying. It's not like, you know, it's not like every university is full of Black Lives Matter leaders or followers or it's, you know, the socialists of America are controlling all the universities. I know that they are controlling lots of universities.
The Jacobins control the universities.
Jeff. Right. No, I know.
Control the newspapers.
That's not my point. My point is that while that's true and that is the larger picture, but there are people like Lowry out there. There are definitely minds. And it's interesting when you hear him say that, you know, he gets students in Ivy League schools will come to his class and say, I don't agree with anything you've said because I've been taught this way my whole life to believe X, but I really appreciate the opportunity to listen to Y. And that's a little bit of, you know, reassurance and that the Republic has a future if that people can at least see what's happening. And I think you and I have alluded to it, and he alluded to it, that there is this pendulum swing where people are starting to see what's happening and see how this idea of, take Illinois, for example, this rush to quote unquote reform police in the state is going to lead to so many other problems. And it's like a rush to do something without the forethought of, hey, how's it actually going to play out, or how's this actually going to impact things? And those are the same mistakes that have blighted places in Chicago, like Professor Lowry's former neighborhood, that this idea that, oh, well, we can fix the problems in the Black community. Just give us, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. Well, what have you thought about this? Is there a 10-year plan? Do you know any ideas of that? What might not work? No, just trust us. We'll cram this through.
We're on a 60-year plan.
Right. Well,
60 years since the Great Society, the benevolent dictators of the left imposed this on people, and it helped destroy the Black family.
Absolutely.
Destroy the Black family, destroy the Black community. And what you're left with are people leaderless and a bunch of white guys with, you know, slogans,
right,
organizing them. And, you know, it reminds me of hearing him. I could imagine, you know, like those cliche movies like Barbershop and that idea where there's always like an old guy, an old school guy, sure, something like maybe Will Lee will be that guy someday. Right. I love him too. But some old school guy who's listening to blah, blah, blah. And then he's just starts chuckling to himself. Right.
Right.
Because my experience has been that Black people, at least in Chicago, are generally conservative, faith-based, loving. They love babies. They don't want to kill babies. I mean, it's just completely opposite to the wokerati that think to rule them. And I think he's right, Jeff.
He certainly is.
It's the issue, and that people have to stand up and fight it.
Yeah, I think we are. I mean, I think just the sheer fact that, and this is, you know, just so stupid and ironic to me, but the fact that Kim Fox now is like, oh, well, maybe we should look at our policy of retail thefts and how we handle that. Oh, maybe now, even though we've been calling, everyone's been saying, this is a terrible idea. It's going to be a bad idea. And yes, we get it. You want to stop incarcerating Black men at a higher rate than white men. Okay, but that's probably not going to help, because what happens to people, to criminals, when they think that they're not going to get prosecuted or they're not going to get, you know, nothing's going to happen.
She's encouraged right. Violence and
right.
Those Lightfoot, and Lightfoot is such a coward. She's not even, she knows what Fox is, and she's not willing to even say it.
Right.
Which is why I lost it. And then she runs around sucking up to her and Tony, the whole thing.
It's just Jeff,
the whole thing. I wish I would make a philosopher king like Glenn Lowry. If I could make Glenn Lowry and Paul Vallis rule in tandem, like from ancient times, like Thebes or something. If we had like a group of seven that would run everything for us in this city, we might be okay.
Yeah,
all we got is the Chicago way.
Jeff. Yeah, that's it. It's absolutely.
Well, I know Jeff's going to have fun cutting all this, but but can I say before we go, we're going to have another podcast before Christmas, and I hope you listen in.
Yes, our tradition, our annual Christmas podcast, which we'll have Jeff. Up next week.
For Professor Glenn Lowry, born in Chicago, a freedom fighter, fighting for the freedom of all Americans to think for themselves. Then for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, a man tasked now with cutting this extensive podcast down to size. Good luck, Jeff. I'll probably be writing about it, so I don't have to worry about cutting. I just want the audio.
Yep.
And for me, John Cass, husband, father of johncassnews.com. Sign up because we're going behind a paywall. Tell your friends. I can't write for free forever. After all, we are not communists. Welcome. And thank you for joining us on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.